car push button start, or does it have a key?
My Jeep is push button. The 68 Impala is not.
Okay, well, back then. I just realized the other day, I've never had a car that doesn't have push to start ignition.
Really?
So I got my first car in 2013, so I had never driven before that. All of them had like push buttons, right?
Yeah.
So I'm house sitting for a friend and I had to go start his wife's car. And I did that. It was fine. I put the key in, turned it, all good. I couldn't get the key out. Like, I couldn't figure out how to get the key out. I'm sitting in this garage, like, Googling Toyota, how to get the key out of the ignition. I had to call my husband. Like, I had no idea what was happening. Oh, apparently you have to turn it even further back.
Yes. Just disconnect the battery. That's how you do it.
I was literally just going to, like, leave it and peace out and hope no one noticed and be like, how did that happen?
Wasn't me.
Wasn't me. Anyway, well, moral of the story, don't let me house it.
Yeah, fair.
Listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to another episode of Murder Unscripted, the true crime podcast that immerses you in the genre like never before. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Heyo!
All right, Melissa, we are halfway through April, which means halfway through our theme of the month.
Well, first of all, I can't believe we're halfway through April. And yes, halfway through our theme of spring cleaning. You deep cleaned our Murder Unscripted Pod Gmail. And you pulled out some of the case suggestions from you guys, our listeners. And my goodness, you guys have hit this out of the park. You have come up with some incredible cases. And my goodness, our case today is no exception because it is a doozy.
Oh, man, I'm excited. I don't know if anything can top your two-parter from the last couple weeks. But before we jump in, I want to take a moment and thank our listeners so much for tuning in every week. And please, if you like what you're hearing, like, subscribe, rate, do the things. We really appreciate it. All the things. I mean, we appreciate you guys so much, and it helps us continue to grow, continue to get the word out about these stories. And yeah, so you can find us at, I never do these. It's what? Murder Unscripted
pod.
On socials, Murder Unscripted Pod on what is it?
Gmail.
On Gmail, Murder Unscripted Pod at gmail.com. And
www.murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com.
No. It's a website. Melissa, where can people find us?
Scratch everything Ed just said. Go to our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. Send us an email at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com or hit us up on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, @murderunscripted.
Perfect. They're all just saved in my favorites. So that's how you get to our stuff. Just go into my favorites and click the link.
See you guys. Oops. Okay, wait. I was just about to say you can see who the real professional is here as I knock my computer across the desk.
Serves you right. Karma's
a bitch.
All right,
scratch that. All right, well, moving on. Today's case was suggested by Diane. So, Diane, thank you so much. This was a really interesting case. And a big thank you to one of our amazing research producers, Sue Grice, for putting together this case for us. Because my two-parter last week and the week before took a little longer than anticipated, and I need to call in reinforcements. So for today's case, Sue and I debated like on how we wanted to tell you, Ed, and our listeners, because the story is all over the place. But buckle up, because we have all the key ingredients to make a blockbuster movie. Or is it possible that a blockbuster movie laid the blueprint that led to this murder?
Oh, man, this sounds a lot like our October block, Hollywood Horrors.
It's true. And well, from that block, we learn that life is usually crazier than movies. But this film and this murder actually came up in my research back in October. So I'm really glad I didn't cover it, but I'm really glad we get to now. So my case today, I want you guys to keep this question in the back of your minds. Was the right person convicted and sentenced for murder, or did the real mastermind the perfect plan to get away with murder?
It does sound like a movie plot.
That movie you're thinking of was probably the 1987 blockbuster Fatal Attraction, starring Glenn Close, and Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
And actually, today's case is the 1989 infamously dubbed Fatal Attraction murder of Betty Jean Solomon.
It's been a long time since I've seen Fatal Attraction, but man, that is a hell of a movie and a sleeper as for like best psychological thriller. I mean, they're awesome. Glenn Close's character, Alex Forrest, was actually voted one of the top 15 like psychopaths in movies ever, because she portrayed this borderline personality disorder to a T. She had all of it. She was impulsive. She devalued other people. She'd constantly flip shit on everybody. It felt so real. And if you're saying you have a case crazier than that, I am excited.
This case is going to be a close second, but we can discuss that along the way. So we are starting off on Sunday, January 15th, 1989 at 11:42 p.m. and we're in Scarsdale, New York. 911 receives a call from a man who sounds pretty shaken up, saying that he thinks his wife is dead and that she's bleeding out on the floor. So Detective Richard Constantino responds to the call and he arrives at the Scarsdale Ridge Apartments Building A, Apartment 12, which happens to be on the third floor of this apartment building. So upon entering the apartment, he was taking in like as much sensory information as he could, including the fact that he didn't see any signs of forced entry. There's cash sitting out on the table. There's like laundry sitting on the arm of the couch. And there's a woman's glove just laying on the floor, like kind of underneath the arm of the couch. And then, of course, he sees our victim, 40-year-old Betty Jean Solomon, laying face up on the living room floor between the couch and like this big, very 1980s stereo unit against the wall.
They were entire pieces of furniture back then.
Literally, like the whole wall.
Yeah.
Well, Betty Jean was pronounced dead at 2:15 a.m. and Detective Constantino got straight to work.
Can I just stop for a second before you keep going? Because this is a good tie-in. There is a caliber of human beings out there, these first responders. They're firefighters, they're police officers, they're detectives. They never know what they're walking into when they're responding to a call. But they continue to do it day in and day out, you know? So, and I say that because it's a little teaser about the topic that we have coming up with our guest later this month.
It's true, it is. I can't wait for that. But I know these people are so amazing. And you know, like, I love when we have a badass cop involved. And this guy is wonderful. Our guy, Detective Constantino, he went next door and he finds the 911 caller, Paul Solomon. And he's the husband of our victim, Betty Jean. So he notices blood on Paul's clothing. And when he goes to speak to Paul, Paul's like cowering and like whimpering during the whole conversation. So Paul tells Constantino that he had left around 6:30 that night to go bowling with friends. And when he came home later that evening, he just found his wife like that, laying dead on the floor. Paul said that she had been face down. And when he rolled her over, he saw a large amount of blood around her head and her chest.
See, this kind of immediately tells me that it wasn't a burglary. And I feel like unless the killer snuck in and surprised her, that it was someone she knew.
I guess we'll see. So the rest of the responding officers spent the early hours of the morning like knocking on doors, you know, throughout the building. Only we told that like no one saw or heard anything. And they're searching around this apartment complex. They're looking through bushes and foliage and they're like searching dumpsters for any additional evidence or a murder weapon. And as the initial part of the investigation wrapped up, as the husband and the last person to see Betty Jean alive and being the one to find her body, Paul Solomon is obviously at the top of their suspect list.
that's standard protocol in every case, especially in one where its victim has a significant other. They're the person you always start with because you want to rule out those romantic motives, things that insurance motives, things that go on like that. And statistically speaking, he should be the first person because most murders in the USA are committed by someone who knows the victim.
Yeah. And I mean, there are literally t-shirts that you can buy that say the husband did it. But back to the case. So who was Betty Jean Solomon? Unfortunately, like a lot of cases that end up with sensationalized media coverage, information on the victim gets lost or overlooked. And Betty Jean, her situation is really no different. So she was born Betty Jean Torrey. She grew up in New York as the oldest of four siblings. And she has been described as outgoing, really kind. She was a hard worker. And she, above all, she was a very dedicated mother. And oh my God, I love this. One of her former coworkers said that Betty Jean was like a freshly corked bottle of champagne. She was just bubbly all the time.
What beverage would you be if it described you?
What beverage would I be? I want to say bitter, like black coffee, but I think that I would actually be like a lukewarm bottle of flat Crystal Pepsi. Do you remember that? Like, and my theory on that is like, I seem pretty cool, but once you get to know me, oof, it is a foul tasting disappointment.
I low-key love Crystal Pepsi, but it is an acquired taste, so that actually fits you perfectly.
Doesn't it? Of course you love that. No one likes Crystal Pepsi except for you, which is clearly why we're friends. Aw, I love you too. Anyway, I know we hate this true crime trope, but it seems like Betty Jean really did actually light up a room. And while her time in this world was tragically short, she truly made it a better place. So Betty Jean graduated high school in 1966, and the following fall, she attended SUNY New Paltz in New York, where in her first year, she actually met Paul Solomon. The two became an item, and after her second year, she actually dropped out, and she married Paul in 1970. The couple welcomed their only child, a daughter named Kristen, in 1973. And the family eventually settled and started their life in Greenberg, New York, where Paul was working as a school teacher, and Betty Jean worked as an account executive for a collection agency. From the outside looking in, the Solomons looked like they were a pretty typical family, but remember, I said this case might just be crazier than the movies, and digging a little deeper into the couple's marriage, it sounds like there were a lot more rocky moments than stable ones. At one point, Betty Jean did consider leaving the marriage, but they both loved their daughter, and I feel like that was the biggest reason they both kind of stayed in this marriage. I didn't find any reports about any kind of major fighting or violence between Betty Jean and Paul. I think that they maybe just kind of fell out of love with each other, which can happen.
I totally get it. Happens all the time.
Yeah, so they did... Apparently, they decided to find an alternative arrangement, with it being reported that Betty Jean was involved in a long-term 9-year affair, and Paul carried on many, many affairs over the years.
It's one way to do it. But I mean, in all seriousness, I think this type of arrangement was a lot more common for marriages back then. You know, it has such a divorce had such a stigma around it. And at the end of the day, if your life works and you don't want to blow it up, I mean, and both people in the relationship agree to this kind of arrangement, then who are we to judge? Go for it.
No, I agree. Although I'm not going to lie, I have some mixed feelings about Paul. And as Detective Constantino's number one suspect, he clearly felt the same way about Paul. So he did what detectives do, and he brought Paul to the station. And during the interview, Paul went into more detail about how the previous day had unfolded. So Paul explained that their daughter, Kristen, had been away on a ski weekend, so it was just him and Betty Jean in the house. He said they slept in, they were intimate that morning, they had a late breakfast, and then they just watched some TV.
Perfect day.
Right. And then around 2 p.m., the phone rang, and it was a woman named Caroline Warmus. Paul made plans to get together with Carolyn later that evening at Treetops Lounge at the Holiday Inn, because who doesn't love a hotel bar? And that was in Yonkers. So at about 6:30 that night, Paul left Betty Jean and he went to a bowling alley where he stayed for a little bit, but then he left to go to the Treetops Lounge, arriving at about 7:30 p.m. And then Carolyn showed up about 20 minutes later, so it's almost about 8 o'clock. The pair enjoyed a few drinks together until about 10:30 p.m., and then they made their way outside to Carolyn's car, where they did in fact have sex. So then Paul left about 11:30 to go back to his home, and Carolyn left to go back to her place in New York City.
I don't get it. You had this amazing Sunday morning with your wife, and you end up going to have an affair in the parking lot of a hotel the same day.
Yeah, you caught that too? That's exactly what I said. Like,
yeah.
First of all, I don't necessarily believe the fact that, like, that he says that he and Betty Jean were intimate. Like, I feel like that ship had sailed if they're truly seeing other people. Whatever. And then I don't know if Paul was being cheap or if he just didn't want to leave a paper trail with, like, the credit card or hotel charge on the credit card statement. But yes, they really went and had sex in her car in a hotel parking lot.
What'd you say that other woman's name was?
So her name is Carolyn Warmus. And if this was the movie Fatal Attraction, she would be Glenn Close's character, a.k.a. the other woman.
So here we are in the real life plot twist of the crazy movie real life thing mashup.
Exactly. Look at you following along, gold star.
I get it.
But yes, for the detective and for us, Carolyn is definitely a plot twist. So who is she? Well, in 1989, Carolyn Warmus was a vivacious young blonde, 25-year-old. She was also a teacher and she worked with Paul. Carolyn got this teaching job about 2 years prior when she was freshly out of college, young 23-year-old. And the school, when she got the job, they had assigned her to kind of like a mentor. And that mentor happened to be 40-year-old Paul Solomon. So before we go into more detail, I want to give you a little bit about Carolyn's background. So like I said, she was vivacious. She's outgoing. She's sexy and she's flirty. And it really sounds like she was just one of those people that everyone noticed, for good or bad, when she walked into a room. Carolyn had grown up outside of Detroit in Troy, Michigan, with her mom and her two siblings. Her parents had divorced, and actually her father, who at the time was like super elite level rich, like worth $150 million, which today in 2025 money, we're talking about $400 to $500 million.
Wow, he's loaded.
This girl was clearly taken care of, able to go anywhere and do anything she wanted. Literally, her dad owned 8 jets, 2 yachts, 15 cars, and he had these sprawling estate homes in Michigan, Florida, Arizona, and New York.
Man, so with wealth like that, I got to say, it's pretty impressive that she wanted to get a job right out of college, because I could see her just kind of being a golden child, taking years off to go backpacking in Europe or something.
Yeah, total nepo baby. I get it. And that's a good point. And I wish I didn't know her, and I still don't know her now, but I don't know how I feel about 1989 Carolyn versus 2025 Carolyn, but we'll get there. So Carolyn was really smart, and friends said she had a warmth about her, and she had always loved kids, so teaching just seemed like a really natural calling for her. She was living in New York City, and she had a very active social life, and then she was commuting up to Scarsdale for work. So at the time, she was teaching 5th grade, and Paul was teaching 6th grade in the room, like, right across the hall from her. So one day while at work, Paul stops in her classroom, and he told her a bunch of teachers were going to get together for, like, drinks after school, like a little happy hour, and he's like, hey, do you want to come with us? And of course, our social butterfly is not going to turn down a social invite. So she's like, absolutely. So the rest of the school day goes on. She leaves after work. She meets up where Paul told her to. When she gets there, apparently Paul had pulled a fast one on her because no other teachers had showed up.
Oh, smooth.
More like creepy, but whatever. So the two started up like a little flirtation, and After that, they started to actively see each other. And Caroline, at first, she didn't know that Paul was married. But when it finally came out, Paul told Caroline that, you know, yes, he was married, but he and Betty Jean were both seeing other people and they had an open arrangement.
The old open arrangement. What a perv move.
I know. I feel like whenever we hear that in true crime stories, I'm like, it's not true.
Yeah, it's never true.
Well, Caroline she believed him and she seemed to be okay with what he was telling her and she decided to keep seeing him. So much so that she accepted his invitation when he invited her to his house with Betty Jean and their daughter Kristen being there. And I guess everyone hit it off because soon Caroline was going with Paul and Betty Jean to watch and cheer on Kristen at her basketball games. At one point, Betty Jean even agreed to let Kristen go with Caroline for a ski trip. So Caroline was like part of this family.
So this is weird to me because I do feel like one of two things could be happening. Either they were really in an open relationship and that's why Betty Jean didn't mind Caroline hanging around the family and getting to know everybody because, like, who cares, you know? Or right. He was touting her as like this friend that he'd met and was just bringing her around so that he could still see her on the side, because now once you gain the trust of the family, it won't look as now we can do our thing behind closed doors. And maybe that this little girl then unfortunately developed this like big sister relationship and Betty Jean didn't really know how to handle it.
Yeah. And if you think about it, I don't know how old Kristen was at this time, but it's almost like Caroline might have been closer to the daughter's age than Paul's age. So maybe Betty Jean thought that he really was her mentor. I don't know. It's a weird situation.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the early morning of January 16th, 1989. Detective Constantino had just learned about Caroline from Paul, and he needs to verify this alibi. So at 6 a.m., the police show up at Caroline's apartment in New York City, and they informed her of Betty Jean's death. She's completely shocked, and then she's told that Paul was the prime suspect, so she's even more shocked, and she agrees to go with the police to be interviewed. So from clips of this interview that I've been able to find online, Caroline seems really calm and really collected. She was pretty much telling the police that Paul and Betty Jean share a life and a child together, and that while there is like a platonic love there, Paul wasn't in love with Betty Jean. So again, I don't know how Betty Jean felt, but that's how it was kind of phrased. So overall, the police agreed that Caroline was cooperative, she's pretty upbeat, and she didn't have any anger or animosity in her voice while talking about Paul or Betty Jean, and she just came across as a pretty open book. After the initial interview, Paul, who was sensing the heat from the police, he retained a lawyer and became pretty uncooperative. Caroline, on the other hand, she did not retain a lawyer, and you know, wanting to believe that she had good judgment in people's character, she truly believed that Paul couldn't have been responsible for Betty Jean's death. So a few days after the memorial service for Betty, Caroline reached out to Paul asking when they would be able to see each other again. Because remember, they had been hot and heavy, even sleeping together the night of this murder. Well, Paul kind of gives her the cold shoulder by saying, like, yeah, maybe eventually, but I can't do anything right now because, you know, I really need to be here for Kristen. She was 15, so he really needed to be with her during this horrible time of her mother's death. So Caroline was like, okay, and then she asks him if she could continue writing letters to him, which, you know, I do love my handwritten letters, but these are kind of weird. So she had been writing letters to him, like, throughout their year and a half long relationship. And I guess Paul didn't want to cut things off completely at this point. And he was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. And you can just drop them off in my school mailbox. And I should mention that by this point, Caroline was not working with Paul. Like, she had started working in a different school district. So they weren't in direct contact. They weren't in the same building, etc.
Gotcha.
But let's pause here for a minute because we got to talk about these letters Caroline sent to Paul. She would like glue or tape pictures on the page, and it wasn't anything like risque, but It was like a fun thing she had done with friends or like stuff she had done at work. And then she would write notes about who the people were in the pictures, like kind of like a page from a journal or like a scrapbook page. But my feeling on what she's doing, like nowadays, if you want to like prove how great your life is, you just put up all these fun pictures on Facebook and like hope it makes your ex jealous or whatever. Yeah. So I feel like that's what she was doing prior to social media. Like, oh my God, look at how much fun I'm having with all these people. I'm doing so great. Obviously, I don't need you.
People documented memories differently back then. Like, look at some of the hard copy pictures you see. Like, they're organized in a certain way. There's information written all over the back of it. So I think some of that is just the sign of the times. That's just people didn't, it's the equivalent of what we do today, just digitally, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I get that, but like some of these letters she sent were just crazy and just, they give off these weird vibes. And remember, he's not writing back to her. So she's just sending him these weird like status updates on her life. And she's saying like, I love you and I'm thinking of you and Kristen often and just stuff like that.
So I think Paul, maybe felt some kind of heat at this point and was probably advised by his lawyer to cut things off with Carolyn because that's definitely not a good look, you know? So like, you don't want to be continuing your relationship with this much younger woman you were having an affair with after your wife was just brutally murdered. I mean, that's at the same time, he probably didn't want to cut off all ties with her because he wanted to leave the door open to like go back to her once the dust settled.
I think you're right. That's totally fair. And that's the vibe I got. And oh, well, I didn't tell you this part. There's also the fact that he had started dating other women not long after Betty Jean's death.
Then maybe he doesn't want Carolyn at all.
Like, he's just kind of trying to ghost her without completely ghosting her kind of thing.
Well, yeah, because he probably still likes sleeping with her when it's convenient.
Of course. So those red flags with Paul, let's just say the wind is starting to pick up. So at this point, the police are still actively investigating everything. And they're able to interview Paul again, of course, with his lawyer present. And during the interview, Paul reveals a few more subtle details about Carolyn by saying, you know, there's maybe a little bit of jealousy about Betty Jean. And he also told police that while he couldn't confirm it, he did think that Betty Jean had been having her own affair. Which, going back to the beginning, you know, when he was so like, oh yeah, everyone's seeing other people, this is so open, blah, blah, blah. But now you're saying maybe she was having an affair? Like, his whole open marriage thing is kind of falling apart. But police decide to look into this, and after talking with coworkers of Betty Jean, police started looking into her relationship with a supervisor, as the rumors were that that's maybe who she was seeing. So this supervisor, John Bourne, he was interviewed and confirmed that he did have a long-term affair with Betty Jean, but they had ended it a while back and that there were no problems between them.
It's strange, and I don't know which way I'm leaning, because the fact that they're using the word affair makes me think it wasn't an open relationship. They would just be like seeing someone on the, like, they would use it a little more loosely. And also, Betty Jean's dead, so we're never going to know. You know, we just have this sign.
Exactly. I know, the whole time I'm like, was this open? Was this not? Like, it's so,
it's tricky.
So all over the place. So police check out John's alibi and it checks out, and he was cleared as a potential suspect. So cross potential affair partner off the list. So this investigation really became a high profile case, and the police were working their butts off conducting hundreds of interviews and checking on every tip that came in, including like close to a dozen different interviews with Paul, just hoping that maybe he would slip up. But red flag Paul, he stayed very consistent and didn't give anything up. Like, he did not slip up at all. So the ballistic report finally comes back, and the murder weapon was identified as a Beretta Jetfire automatic handgun. And it apparently it holds 8 rounds in the clip and 1 in the chamber. And Betty Jean had 9 gunshot wounds on her body. So basically, that means whoever the shooter was, they fired until they were out of bullets. So the ballistic report was also able to show that the bullets that were fired through a silencer. And I don't know if you caught what I said earlier, but on the night of the murder, when police were like canvassing all the neighbors, all of them had said, like, we didn't see and we didn't hear anything.
And that makes total sense if they used a silencer. But at the same time, it also proves that this was absolutely a premeditated murder and that whoever the shooter was wanted to make sure she was dead. Like, you bring a silencer and you empty all of your bullets into somebody. This isn't just some random attack.
Yeah. And I feel like all 9 bullets, that shows like a lot of anger, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why they talk about interviewing the people closest to the victim. Like, was there some bad blood? Was there a vendetta? Was there some personal issue that caused this kind of overkill?
The police had a lot of the same questions that you and I are talking about. So this investigation was going nowhere fast for the Greenberg Police Department. Now, this community didn't see a whole lot of homicides. So that can mean that sometimes police aren't always that experienced investigating these sort of crimes. Case in point, the first officers to arrive at the scene, they didn't test for gunshot residue on Paul's hands.
Oh man, that's 101.
And by the time that Detective Constantino arrived, Paul, who had Betty Jean's blood on him from rolling her over, they had let him wash his hands.
Any evidence on that guy is gone.
Yep. And then there was one fingerprint that had been found at the crime scene that they were never able to match and account for. Remember how I said that Constantino took in a ton of sensory information when he arrived?
Yeah.
Well, he had noticed a woman's glove on the floor next to the couch. Remember, it was like under the arm of the couch where the laundry had been. And it was like, so it was kind of in between the couch and Betty Jean's body.
Okay.
Well, somehow that glove was never collected as evidence.
Yeah, there's a lot of botched investigation here, unfortunately.
Yeah. The police actually went back to the apartment, like after it had been released to Paul, and they asked him if he had come across the glove since he had gotten back to the apartment. And of course, Paul's going to say, nope, I've never seen it. Never seen a glove. What is that?
Right.
And lastly, it's 1989 and DNA testing was still incredibly new. So the police department didn't run any evidence that they had taken for DNA.
Yeah, you hate to see that. And seriously, how many cases have we covered or ones that you've heard where homicide is thankfully not something that happens very often? So when it does, the police do miss these clues and they're very critical steps in those initial stages, and it can make or break an entire investigation.
Obviously, the officers didn't do any of this intentionally, but it really made them to have to play the long game for this investigation. So a solid 6 months go by with no leads. I mean, Paul is still the prime suspect, but the police just don't have the evidence they need to make an arrest. So he's just out about and living his best life, which if he didn't do this, like, I'm glad he's able to be there for Kristen. But still, for police, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
So aside from those letters, Paul still hadn't had really any communication with Carolyn. So, you know, she's out there living her life and apparently she's seeing other people, which I guess is good because, like I said, Paul had been seeing people. And by now, he actually had a new girlfriend whose name was Barbara. But after these 6 months, I guess Paul had some questions for Carolyn. And he decided one night to drive to New York City and he waited outside of her building until she got home from work. And he wanted to have a chance to talk with her. So he asked her if she had anything to do with Betty Jean's death, and she said, of course not. And since the police told her he was their prime suspect, she asked him the same question.
Fair.
Right. But I don't know if this weird conversation was their kind of foreplay, because according to Carolyn, after all that was asked, they ended up going up to Carolyn's apartment and rekindling their sexual relationship.
Like, did you kill her? No. Did you? No. All right, good. That's a, with that out of the way. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, some people have weird kinks. You do you.
But wow.
Paul's account in official records is a little bit different. He denies that they had sex, but he did admit that the two ended the night with passionate kissing. So I'm not sure who's telling the truth here, but either way, something did in fact happen that night. And From this point on, Paul and Carolyn have very different accounts of what happens basically the rest of this case up until this day.
What happens is Paul's a hound.
Seriously. Paul, control yourself. All right. Are you still with me? Because it is time for another plot twist in the real life movie drama that we got going on here.
Absolutely. I'm dying to hear what happens next.
Oh, man. Here we go. So it's August of 1989, and Carolyn, who is still on summer break from teaching, she decides to take a trip home to Michigan to see her family. And because our girl Carolyn is a fancy AF, she has, at her New York City apartment, this fancy-schmancy high-tech answering machine. And she can actually call into the answering machine and listen to her messages without being there. And surprise, she says she has messages from Paul. And in these messages, he apparently tells her that he was on a trip in Puerto Rico and he wanted to know if Carolyn would like to join him. And Carolyn, this girl is the life of the party and she still has all this free time before school starts. So up for a spontaneous trip, especially to see her man, Carolyn changes her return flight not to go home to New York, but for a flight to Puerto Rico to meet up with Paul.
Isn't he seeing this Barbara woman? Weird.
Yep. So, before Carolyn leaves, she calls Paul's hotel and left a message for him, letting him know what time her flight was due to land. And then, once she got to the airport, she finds out that there's an earlier flight, so she decides to hop on that one, heads to Puerto Rico, and away she goes. Like, desperate much? But anyway.
Yeah.
So Carolyn lands in Puerto Rico. Paul is nowhere to be found, which kind of seems a little weird. But Carolyn is like, well, maybe he didn't get his messages yet because, you know, she had taken an earlier flight. Whatever. No big deal. So Carolyn grabs a taxi and decides to go to the hotel like on her own. Like, he's not at the airport. So she's like, I'll just surprise him at the hotel. Well, once at his hotel, Paul is still nowhere to be found. And like, personally, I'd be pissed, but
yeah.
Carolyn decides to find a room at a neighboring hotel. I guess there were no more available rooms at this hotel, which in my head, I'm like, why didn't you just wait for him? Like, wouldn't you be sharing a room? But
yeah, that's the point.
Right. Well, apparently not. So Carolyn freshens up after traveling. And she writes a note for Paul. This is where I'm staying at blah, blah, blah hotel. And she includes her room key. So she leaves all of this with the people at the front desk of his hotel. But even after leaving this note for him, to her complete shock, Carolyn doesn't hear from Paul. Like, at all.
When he invited her. It's weird.
Right. So she's getting frustrated at this point. She just kept calling, like, his hotel and leaving voicemails. And Carolyn's now completely confused, and she's out of, like, excuses in her own head. So she starts calling his New York apartment, and she even starts calling his lawyer to see if the lawyer knows what's going on.
She's insane.
Mm-hmm. So the next day, she stays overnight there. The next day, on Saturday, August 19th, Carolyn calls Paul's New York apartment again, and while in the middle of leaving a voicemail for him, lo and behold, Paul picks up.
He's not even in Puerto Rico. Yeah.
Right. So because he picked up while she was leaving a voicemail, this conversation is actually recorded. So Carolyn is asking Paul, like, what is going on? Why am I sitting alone in Puerto Rico waiting for you? And another red flag. Paul starts speaking incredibly sternly towards her. He kept saying, I told you we can't see each other. You need to live your life and I need to live mine. I made that very clear to you.
Then maybe he shouldn't have left her a voicemail saying, meet me in Puerto Rico. Little mixed messages there.
You think? So Carolyn responds with, quote, but yeah, you also made everything else very clear the night when you saw me. End quote.
True, too. This is on him.
So she's like, and why the hell am I in Puerto Rico? Like, if you know, and he denies calling her or leaving any messages on her answering machine. and he just continued to drive home the fact that they cannot see each other anymore. So Carolyn is now mad, she's frustrated, and of course she's disappointed. So Carolyn makes her way back to New York as, you know, and at this point the summer's coming to an end, and she needs to get ready for the school year. So Paul and Carolyn's stories no longer match up. What Paul ends up telling police back in New York, who are still investigating the murder of his wife, he says that Paul and Barbara had taken a trip to Puerto Rico. Then, after having to get security involved, they had to cut their trip short because Paul was in fear of his life due to the fact that Carolyn Warmus had flown to Puerto Rico uninvited and was leaving all these messages and notes for him with the assumption that she had been invited.
Super stalkery.
Oh my God, right? So I also told you that Detective Constantino was just waiting to get some key information from Paul, like waiting for him to like slip up a little or say a little bit more. So he's able to take what Paul had to say and he's like, maybe I should be talking to Carolyn a little bit more. So starting with phone records, Constantino went back and mapped every call he could find, which led to him tracing a call from Carolyn to a woman named Tammy Rogers. And Tammy Rogers just happens to be Barbara's roommate.
Okay.
Now, Carolyn uses a fake name, and she's able to find out from Tammy where Barbara was, thereby finding out where Paul was, and they were both in Puerto Rico.
That makes me think that Paul never called, that Paul had nothing to do with this. And he was in Puerto Rico with Barbara enjoying a vacation.
Yep. And then this crazy bitch shows up. And I want to say, generally, I would not call like the other woman a crazy bitch because the man is just as culpable. Yes. But in this case, you're showing you're crazy.
Yeah. Yep.
So while they were in Puerto Rico, remember, Carolyn herself said that she was calling everyone back home like to figure out where Paul was.
She's admitting she's crazy.
Well, hold on. It gets worse. She ended up calling Barbara's mother. Barbara's mother. Again, she's using a fake identity. This time, she claims she's a detective with the Greensburg Police Department and asks if she knew, if Barbara's mother knew that her daughter was on a trip with a man named Paul Solomon, who's the prime suspect in a murder investigation.
Cue the crow. Like, this is insane.
Wait, what? What does that mean?
Cue the crow. That's something we used to use on City Confidential. We would literally write it into the scripts. It was just like an internal, like, not a joke, but it was the moment that a case would take the turn. We call it the turn. Something ominous happened. So that's when you would like hear a murder of crows, like cawing in the background when something dark and twisty is going to happen.
So cue the crow is kind of like the dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And may I point out the irony with a group of crows being called a murder?
It's not an accident, my friend. It's double entendre. Is that what they call it? Double, when it means
I think so. Yeah. Or innuendo?
One of those. Onomatopoeia? No.
Somebody will write it and tell us why we're idiots.
Please.
So, we're used to that at this point. Well, this is definitely the point where the crows are circling Carolyn. And instead of calling, they're going, dun, dun, dun.
That'd be weird.
That'd be awesome. But anyway, so she is definitely at the top of Detective Constantino's suspect list. And his gut feeling, she's starting to unravel. So this gut feeling's leading him to think that, and then that she killed Betty Jean. She thought that that would lead to her and Paul being together, but now it's been 7 months and they aren't together. So at this point, she's doing whatever she can to get herself back into his life. But the police and Constantino, they don't have any solid evidence to tie Carolyn to this murder. And as much as I wish we could, we can't make an arrest on a gut feeling.
It's a fact.
Because my story of the past 2 weeks would have been 10 minutes long if we could have done that.
And you know how many perpetrators, actual murders, would be free because police charged them too quickly without having their ducks in a row and a jury didn't. You got to get a jury to believe it.
Mm-hmm. So, back to the phone records, Constantino goes, like, painstakingly, he's digging through every freaking call record. And a big find is all these calls from Carolyn to a private investigating firm. So off to Manhattan, Constantino goes to talk in person to this PI and to try to figure out what they have to, like, what is this PI doing in this whole mix of characters? Like, why is this happening? So he meets with PI Vincent Parco. And Parco tells Constantino that Carolyn had hired him to do surveillance in New Jersey on a married man named Matthew, whom Carolyn had been having an affair with. Clearly, she has a type.
Yeah.
So Carolyn wanted Vincent to take photos of Matthew in various stages of undressing so that she could superimpose herself in the photos and then give them to Matthew's wife in hopes of breaking up their marriage.
Oh my God, she's nuts.
Thank God she didn't have Photoshop, or else more people would have been in trouble.
Yeah, no doubt.
So police are like, wow. So they talk to Carolyn, and she admits to hiring Parco, but she says it was because she wanted to find out if Matthew was married. Because, you know, her relationship with Matthew was going on at the same time as her relationship with Paul, and she was just not interested in getting caught up with another married man. So that's why she hired the PI, not because she wanted to be a super creep peeping Tom.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
So our guy Constantino, he keeps listening to this gut feeling about everything he's finding out. And his gut is screaming at this point. So he knew that there was more that PI Parco wasn't telling him, so he keeps pushing this guy. Finally, on November 15th, 1989, Constantino shows up with a search warrant to Parco's office. And now Parco's back is up against a wall, so he gives up the information that he had been trying to keep from police. Turns out, this PI, Parco, is no Ken Brennan. He had sold Carolyn Wormus a gun with a silencer.
Wow.
Ken would never do that.
He would do no such thing.
Oh, Ken.
That's messed up, though.
It really is. Like, this PI bought her a gun with a silencer. Like, and yeah, he kept that quiet this whole time. Not cool.
Not okay.
So he told police that Carolyn asked him to get her a gun for her own protection, and he knew it was wrong. And frankly, at this point, he's just trying to cover his own ass by keeping that information to himself. As he is, in fact, surprise, surprise, not registered or licensed to be selling guns to people.
Clearly.
It gets better because it's unregistered, but Parco gave a detailed 7-page statement to the police stating that he did sell an unregistered 25 caliber Beretta Jetfire with a silencer, along with a clip and some ammo, for a total of $2,500. Turns out the silencer was homemade. So he allowed them to search his garage area, and he showed them a 2x4 that he had test fired the gun into. And bingo, Constantino had a ballistics match to the gun used in the murder of Betty Jean Solomon.
That's bad news for Carolyn.
I know.
And him. Makes him look guilty.
I don't know if he lost his PI license, but he definitely should have. So you just threw all that away for $2,500.
Yeah. Or she was banging him too. And it was all the things people do for women.
I don't get it.
I should say. Things you do for love. Cause it happens both ways.
I think it's more just to get some, but anyway, so love schmov. So that same day, a search warrant was signed and executed at Carolyn's fourth floor apartment in New York City. There was no evidence found in her apartment that could physically tie Carolyn to the murder, but there was a lot of documentation evidence that police were able to collect, including financial records and a suicide note that included instructions to her family about who to invite to a service for her, and also included the request of being buried with her favorite stuffed animals and photos of Paul and Kristen Solomon.
this case is nuts. Like, we've been, these listener suggestions are better than the ones we come up with, I gotta say.
I know.
At this point, it could literally be either one of them.
Right. Yeah. Either Paul or Carolyn. Yes. Yeah. Or together. Yep. So now it was up to the police to decide exactly that, who had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to pull off this murder. And their first place prime suspect award goes to Carolyn Wormus. Nobody in this episode gets the MU MVP except for maybe Constantino. All these people are shitty. So both Carolyn and Paul, they obviously had a motive and opportunity, but Carolyn, who had the means by being directly tied to the Beretta handgun. So Constantino lays it all out, and he believes that on January 15th, when Carolyn called to make plans with Paul, knowing that Kristen was away, and she also knew what time Paul would be leaving to stop at the bowling alley before meeting with her, like, she knew he had that errand to run. So she knew how long Betty Jean was going to be at the apartment by herself. So she had the opportunity to stop by the apartment, be let in by Betty Jean, of course, because she knows her. So then police think that she pulled out the Beretta with the silencer, emptied the clip, and then just left to go meet up with Paul for drinks and a sex session in her car.
It sounds like.
Yep. So on February 2nd, 1990, Carolyn was officially indicted for murder. And once the media got wind of this story, Carolyn Wormus was infamously dubbed the Fatal Attraction Killer.
I think all roads lead to Carolyn, but at the same time, I don't know how I feel about Paul. I really think, I don't know if he was in cahoots. I definitely don't trust anybody in this case. I mean, they're all a little sleazy. They all have secret lives.
Right. Well, you can see why I've been saying this case really is crazier than the movies.
Facts.
All right. We've covered a lot already, but I really need, we got to talk about this trial, which also had some wild moments. And then we'll catch up with everything that's going on today.
Let's do it.
So this case clearly was a media goldmine. It has sex. It has murder. There's a love triangle. There's a poor little rich girl, and who is now a young and beautiful defendant.
Tabloid fuel.
Oh my God, 100%. I can just imagine, like, the tabloids at the grocery store checkout.
Yeah, exactly. They got her in, like, a fat suit and see, like, murder suspect gained 600 pounds.
And then marries Elvis. Yeah, I feel like there's always, like, or a Loch Ness Monster, something like that. Well, you name it, and the media ran with it on, like, international levels. So before the trial even started, this case is just splashed everywhere. Like we said, tabloids, magazines, newspapers, and everyone's telling, like, their kind of version of a very sensationalized Fatal Attraction storyline, with claims that Carolyn was obsessed with all these different married men, and...
She was.
That's true. Well,
there's that.
Because of all this, Paul was pretty much off the hook in all of these stories. And I'm not saying she doesn't deserve hate, because she does, but it's just like, I feel like at this point, the media just completely was like, oh, Paul's cool, no worries. Like, no, he wasn't. He was a shitbag too.
I know. But that stuff comes out in trial.
Carolyn, with her father's wealth, obviously had access to a top-notch defense lawyer who really tried to get anything about that whole Puerto Rico trip suppressed. Which, you know, that wasn't such a good look on Carolyn's part. But thankfully, the police and the DA's office were pretty relentless in their investigation. And they kind of planned in case that got suppressed. They found this whole string of relationships with Carolyn that had ended problematically. Like, they found a college relationship she had with a man named Paul Lavin, where he was ultimately granted a restraining order against Carolyn.
Wow, so even back then she was cuckoo.
Yeah, so once that was shown to, like, the judge or whatever, they were like, okay, you're able to argue about the Puerto Rico trip, like, that stayed.
Yeah.
So the DA, but this is a weird part. The judge allowed the Puerto Rico trip to be included, but would not allow the DA to bring up her past relationships, as that could be prejudicial against Carolyn.
There's so many weird rules.
Yeah, there's so many weird rules. So that was a big win for Carolyn to get like that part of her life kind of pushed out of the trial. But this girl is just not doing herself any favors during these pre-trial conferences. Like, I don't know what she was thinking with this one, but she showed up for court in this super dramatic outfit. And like, I freaking love it. Not for court, but I just love it in general. She had on this giant brimmed pink hat, a bright pink blazer, and like a matching pretty much mini skirt. She's wearing these sheer black nylon pantyhose, black heels, and of course she's got a fine, snazzy black handbag with her because that always makes the outfit. So she's wearing all of this, all while stepping out of a limo in front of the courthouse.
Given what you've said about Carolyn up to this point, that she was the kind of person that like everyone notices when she steps into a room, but it also, like, this makes sense, but it also gives me Jackie Onassis vibes. Like, that the pink, like, she's just bigger than life. Like, look at me.
Well, this outfit and this whole limo and all that stuff, it did nothing to change the public opinion of her. And over the course of the trial, Carolyn continued to have these dramatic antics when it came to what she was wearing. Like, she was often seen coming and going from court in this long trench coat and usually wearing a big oversized scarf to cover her whole head and her face. So it was kind of like a look at me, but then don't look at me, but still keep looking at me kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know this is a sensationalized case and every little thing is looked at. And honestly, like, I'm kind of confused on who was giving her advice about how she dressed and carried herself. If I was on her defense team, I would have been like, all right, we got a Casey Anthony Jodi Arias thing right now. So let's make you look like this. Let's skip this sexy vibe and go with the innocent, sweet, gentle elementary school teacher vibe.
Yeah. Even if it's not you, like, make it you for the next 2 weeks or whatever.
Exactly. Like, you remember Jodi Arias looked like a freaking like school marm or whatever that is. Like, it's ridiculous. But moving on. So once the trial finally starts, the prosecution presents a totally circumstantial evidence case against Carolyn. They focus in on her obsession with Paul and his daughter, and they lay out everything Constantino and his team found and like how all these pieces together puts Carolyn at the center of everything. And she's really the only possible person who could have killed Betty Jean. The defense, on the other hand, they argue that Carolyn was framed for this murder, alluding to that, like, Paul or even the PI, Parco, were the true killers, and that even with all this circumstantial evidence, they never found the gun, and the police lost the glove to the crime scene, so there was really nothing that physically connected Carolyn to the crime.
Yeah, that's tough.
Carolyn did not want to take the stand, and she didn't take the stand because it would just open a Pandora's box in terms of putting all those past relationships on trial. Red Flag Paul, on the other hand, he accepted complete and total full immunity and took the stand for 5 days of testimony and questioning.
Wow.
But this means that Paul could never be prosecuted for anything relating to the death or murder of Betty Jean.
I don't think he had anything to do with it, though.
Well, hold on. Before the trial had started, his lawyer had already drawn up a legal deal for movie rights about everything in which he was going to make $30,000. So, Wow. Yeah. Like, Paul wasn't amazing, but overall, the jury felt fairly neutral on him when it was all said and done.
Yeah, I can see that.
See, I don't. I just...
It's weird. It's weird. But he didn't have anything to do with it, so... He was not proven to have anything to do
with it. He was not proven. Let's go with that.
Let's leave it at that.
So, up next for the prosecution was P.I. Vincent Parco, our pretend gun seller guy. They thought he was going to be like their star witness as the one to connect Carolyn to the gun. So, their office offered Parco partial immunity for his testimony. I don't love that they're making all these deals on the side. Like, that to me isn't great.
Because they're going after her. They want her.
Right. So this offer basically meant they wouldn't charge him with any crimes involving the selling of the gun, which actually in total could have had Parco facing up to 14 years in prison. So that was like his immunity. But if any evidence connecting him to Betty Jean's murder came to light, he could face those charges. During cross-examination, the defense did a really good job at making Parco look really slimy and like trying to discredit him by portraying Parco as this shady guy that would do anything for money and kind of pointing at him as the alternative suspect.
See, but that's, I agree with that. And that's why I'm coming down hard on him, because you giving someone a gun for protection is one thing. Giving them a silencer is totally different.
Right. And I mean, the fact that he gave this woman a gun, the same gun with a silencer, like to me as a jury member, I'd be like, okay, she clearly did. Like,
yes. Well, either you or she, one of you did it.
One of you, correct. Right. Well, out of all these crazy characters, the prosecution had a surprise witness take the stand tying Carolyn to the gun. That was the school nurse at that other school that Carolyn was working for. Like, not the one where she and Paul worked, but the other right. one. So this school nurse, she testified that Carolyn had spoken with her and told her that she had bought the gun for protection, but she would never use it or kill anyone because she didn't even have any ammunition.
Then why have it for protection?
Right. And like, overall, there wasn't a lot the defense could do to discredit her. But they were kind of able to make everyone in the room question if this was like real testimony or if this witness was planted by the prosecution team. So since the judge allowed in everything about the Puerto Rico trip, the prosecution really focused on everything that happened to show just how obsessed Carolyn was with Paul. So remember, Carolyn claims that she was invited by Paul to join him, but Paul claims that Carolyn just tracked him down and that he actually had to report that to police. So the records of all of Carolyn's calls and the notes that she had left for Paul were all presented to support the prosecution's argument. Remember Tammy Rogers? That was like Paul's girlfriend Barbara's roommate. Mm-hmm. She testified that Carolyn called her using a fake name to find out like where Barbara was. Yeah. And so she took the stand to testify in support of Paul and like what the prosecutor was saying. So then the prosecution came out with another giant hit against Carolyn when on March 18th, they presented phone records from Carolyn's home to Ray's Sports Shop, which, by the way, they sell ammunition. Mm. So the record shows that Carolyn's home phone made a call at 3 p.m. on January 15th, 1989, which was the day of Betty Jean's murder. The police had gone to Ray's Sports Shop and got the records for the 25 caliber ammunition purchase, which required ID to buy, of course.
Right.
Well, the ID on record was the New York license for Lisa Katai.
Wow. So it wasn't even like hers.
Lisa Katai takes the stand because everyone's like, who the hell is this girl? Well,
yeah, where'd she come from?
She explains how her ID went missing from her pocketbook when she was working at a summer job. Lo and behold, the person that she sat next to at that job, Carolyn Warmus.
I was waiting for it.
Yep, she was working there as a temporary secretary.
She was cunning and just a complete narcissist.
Well, to make matters worse for Carolyn, when the prosecution entered the MCI phone company record showing the call to Ray's Sports Shop, the defense entered into evidence an almost identical MCI phone company record that did not have the call logged as a call to Ray's, but instead showed a call to Carolyn's mother's home in Michigan. So same time frame, same day, same everything, but the prosecution showing that it went to Ray's Sports Shop. The defense is showing that the call went to Carolyn's mother's home. So this is obviously a problem, but on Carolyn's record of everything and the defense's record, they were missing one small detail of an actual MCI bill. It was missing MCI's logo, Communications for the Next 100 Years. Hmm. That was stamped on every bill in the bottom right footer. So that meant Carolyn and her defense team entered fraudulent evidence, which then Carolyn would ultimately face additional charges for.
Oops.
Oops. All right.
Great
I know job. There's a lot going right. So I know there's a lot going on, but finally it's the defense's turn to put witnesses on the stand. On April 8th, Carolyn's father, Thomas Wormos, took the stand. And one very interesting side note, this is the only day that anyone from Carolyn's family was in the courtroom for her trial.
Wow.
And as we know, everything is looked at during a trial. So for her parents or siblings not to be in the like the courtroom sitting behind her to offer support, that's kind of pretty damning, I would say, against Carolyn. And Carolyn would claim that she was adamant that in order to protect her family and their privacy, she told them not to come, and it was totally her decision to not have anyone there to support her. So Thomas's testimony was mainly to discredit P.I. Parco, saying that Parco had reached out to Thomas, saying that his daughter was in legal trouble and that he could help her out, but to the tune of a six-figure fee. I don't know how much the jury focused on what Thomas had to say, but they certainly took notice when he was finished with his testimony. Her father got off the stand and walked straight out of the courtroom, not ever even glancing at Carolyn. Wow. Eyes ahead, nothing. So this left the jury to kind of interpret his actions as almost like if he was rejecting her, and maybe he believed that she really was the one to commit this murder. So then, after 13 weeks of testimony, the case was turned over to the jury for deliberations. And 12 days later, they came back as a hung jury. 8 for conviction, 4 for acquittal, which ultimately led Judge Carey to declare a mistrial.
It makes sense because I feel like there were so many variables like that didn't just point to Carolyn as the person who could have done this. So I get that it would be hard to prove it without a reasonable doubt.
The DA decided to retry the case against Carolyn, and the second trial began on January 2nd, 1992. So there were a few key differences in this trial. First of all, Carolyn had a new defense attorney who was kind of the polar opposite personally and defense style from her first lawyer. This time around, the defense took the position that Paul Salomon was the real killer in this case, as he had had enough time to commit the crime, clean himself up, get rid of evidence, and proceed with his evening, which established an alibi at the bowling alley and then with Carolyn.
See, I think he was a sleaze. I don't think he was a killer. I just think he was a sleaze.
I think that he was manipulative. I don't think that he got his hands dirty. We'll say that.
Okay, fair.
So on the prosecution side, they offered a huge surprise discovery into evidence. None other than the black woman's glove that Detective Constantino saw on the night of the murder. But remember, the police never managed to collect it. So, of course, the defense argued as hard as they possibly could to keep this glove out of evidence, with their main argument being that there was no chain of custody for this glove that had been missing for 3 years. So, as it turns out, prior to the start of the second trial, the DA knew they needed that damn glove, and he went back to Paul to try to find it, and miraculously, Paul found it in the apartment. So in yet another plot twist, the judge required the prosecution team to establish admissibility. So after sending the glove for testing, they were able to establish that there was blood on the glove and the fibers that were similar to fibers found on Betty Jean's hands. So the judge ultimately allowed the glove to be entered into evidence.
Okay.
This trial continues following the similar witness list as the first trial. And then on April 6th, the prosecution presents Carolyn's Amex credit card record showing the purchase of the same make and style, of women's black gloves from Filene's basement in the fall of 1988.
The throwback, Filene's basement.
Wow. Filene's, which I thought that was a discount store. Why was Carolyn, like Queen of Park Ave, shopping at a discount store? But true. Anyway, that's what I was most upset about. Anyway, on April 13th, Kristen Salomon, Paul and Betty Jean's daughter, took the stand to testify that, yes, this glove does look like the glove she remembered borrowing from Carolyn while they were on that ski trip they took together almost 4 years ago. On May 21st, 1992, the second trial against Carolyn went to the jury for deliberations. 6 days later, on May 27th, the jury came back with their decision, and this time, they found Carolyn Warmus guilty of the murder of Betty Jean Salomon. Later that year, on June 26th, Carolyn was sentenced to 25 years to life. But in March of 1993, she received an additional concurrent sentence in regards to the fraudulent MCI phone record that her team had presented in the first trial. So Carolyn was sent to Bedford Correctional Facility, where she spent the next 27 years using most of her time in the law library, filing her own appeals, and even requesting DNA testing to be conducted on the evidence used in the trial. All of this was denied. But Carolyn was paroled on June 17th, 2019.
Wow.
Now, she has suffered some pretty major health issues along the way, including a brain tumor that needed to be removed, and it ultimately left half of her face paralyzed. But even with all of that going on, she still claims she was wrongly convicted, and she has been working tirelessly to push for DNA testing to be conducted. And on March 3rd, 2021, the Westchester District Attorney did agree to allow the evidence in the case to be tested. That included the glove, a tote bag that was near Betty Jean's body, and vaginal swabs that were taken from Betty Jean. As of recording this episode, which we're the beginning of April 2025, there is not any public information available with the results of the testing, at least not yet. And I don't know if that means the results aren't ready or if Carolyn is like in the works to present the evidence in like another installment or maybe season two, if you will, of the now titled Carolyn Warmus Project. Originally titled The Fatal Attraction Murder.
Wow.
But as for Paul, in 2011, he left his teaching profession and has been living an incredibly private life. He chooses not to talk to any media or press. And it looks like Kristen, his and Betty Jean's daughter, has followed his lead. So, Ed, what do you think?
I mean, based on what the jury was presented in that second trial, I think I probably would have convicted her as well. But when you open it up and kind of look at everything, I don't know if maybe there's just not enough reasonable doubt to think Carolyn took the fall for Paul and he has like kind of eternal immunity. You know, I think that that played a big role in it. So even if the tides turn and something comes up, it's not like police are going to be able to go after him for anything.
No, I know. And like while digging this case, like I've gone back and forth so many times on how I feel about everyone involved. Although I will say if Carolyn did commit this murder, you would think she would have just gotten paroled and just gone to quietly live her life.
Yeah.
Except, as we said earlier, this woman is a complete narcissist.
Exactly. So it's all about public image too. Like this is about how else can I do damage control even now?
Yeah. And it's like, at this point, everyone's like, nobody cares about you. Like you could be living quietly. But I just don't know. And honestly, at this point, even if she did do it, she may have told herself in her head so many times now that she didn't do it, that she really thinks she didn't. Like,
it's that, what is that? The truth becomes the truth if you tell yourself enough, but you start to believe it.
Exactly.
So, I don't know. I hope we do find out the results of that DNA testing, though, because that's something you can't argue with. And if she was, in fact, wrongfully convicted, then we really do have two victims in this case and a killer who has spent 35 years getting away with murder. And I am not so sure that PI is clean as a whistle.
Yeah.
We would love to know what you guys think about this. Thanks for hanging out. I know this was a long one, so please let us know. And we promise to keep a lookout for any possible updates on Carolyn Warmus and those DNA tests.
Oh, for sure. I mean, a little Google alert. If anything with her name comes up, it'll ding us. But
totally.
Yeah, definitely share your thoughts with us on our socials, Facebook, Insta, and TikTok. We are at Murder Unscripted. Email us murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com or share your thoughts about all of this like through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Absolutely. So we have something very cool coming up next week. One more story before we get to our featured guest, which Melissa mentioned a couple weeks ago, is one of you. It's our a listener, Shannon Byers, who is going to talk to us. I'm not even going to reveal what she's going to talk about. We'll do that next week. But very cool subject matter coming up.
Yeah, and you definitely don't want to miss it. So until our next episode, stay safe, be kind, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But they do apparently look like Jackie Onassis arriving for their own murder trial.
Or maybe they get full immunity. Bye!